This is a Pinball News production.
I'm Rick from... I have multiple personalities. I've always had multiple personalities. It's just now it's transformed into pinball. So I run Bay Area Amusements, which kind of helps figure out what parts people need. You know, so I kind of use that part of my brain to kind of figure out what's, you know, what's in the market, what needs to be in the market, things like that. And then actually just about a year ago, exactly today, we bought the rights for Williams and Bally replacement pinball parts, as well as the ability to make games under a Bally logo. So that resulted in Planetary Pinball, so that's the other side of my brain. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about, is kind of what we've done in the last year and what we need to do. So I have a bunch of slides. I come from a consulting background, so I don't really like slides, but it's good to kind of give an idea of what we're doing, and then we'll have questions, and then I usually give stuff away. I don't know why. It's not economically a great thing to do, but I do it. So anyway, kind of Planetary Pinball, what have we done in the last year? And, you know, I think it's been a great year for pinball parts. I think it's going to continue to be a good year. Lots, if you look back at the last 5-10 years and kind of what's been coming out, it's been accelerating. So I think it's good to have all these parts, all these games, all these companies trying to make pinball happen. So a little bit about what we are is we're a licensee of Williams Electronic Games. We manufacture, sell, and distribute Williams Bally parts. Every now and then we have an oddball part that's not a Williams Bally part, but that's kind of usually a mistake or something. Matt and Rick, so Matt is my partner, Matt Cristiano, some of you know. He was here last year. We manage the company and run the company out of San Jose. We have learned to do digital art reproductions, so we do all of the hardcore graphics artwork in-house. So I have learned that trade, and I have a few people that are, you know, many years in the graphics art department building and doing artwork and getting things done. And then we work with a number of suppliers who get a lot more done. So, you know, I come from a world where I can't do everything, and I know what I can do, and I know what I can't do, and I try to get other people to do what I can't do, and then I do what I do. So that's what we are, and then we're just 1 year old. Okay. I'm going to anybody that's gone to TPF and PPE are going to see roughly the same slides. Next year you're going to see different slides, maybe not even slides, but what goes on in our business is we've got kind of this equation that we have to deal with. And the problem is we've got collector quality. I can't tell you what, you know, I have dealt with the most hardcore collectors, the restorers, and that's who I've sold to for Bay Area, and that's who we sell to with PPS. They expect collector quality, regardless of whether Williams made that way in the beginning. You know, in the beginning, they made a pinball game, and they didn't really put that much emphasis on that every part's going to look identical and be you know, mass produced in a quality way. And that's pretty much the same with any vendor. The expectation is for us that we do. So everything has to be perfect, and if it's not, then a post goes on in, you know, 24 minutes on RGP and 8,000 people hear about it. So we kind of have that problem. We have to do a reasonable price. So everything has to be perfect, but it also has to be cheap, because if it's not cheap, it's expensive, and expensive is not good, especially in a not-so-pleasant economy. So we have to kind of keep an eye on, you know, and the way I've always run my business is I'm a customer. You know, what would I expect to pay, and what would annoy me if I charged this? And I try not to charge that unless I can't avoid it. On the other side of the equation, we have low to no volumes. Pinball is not a mass market to anybody making stuff. I mean, if I go to somebody and make a widget and they say, how many, and I say 100 or 1,000, you know, they're not that excited when they can go, you know, to an aircraft company and get, you know, 1 million or something like that. So So it's a little bit of a problem because the economics are not that great. It's a little bit better right now because people are so hard up. They want business from anywhere, whether it's, you know, one or anything. But that does kind of drive the reasonable price up because your volumes are so low and so forth. So it's a challenge to get kind of low volume. And then things are really hard to make. You know, it's not, you know, doing something like this is just a massive undertaking. You've got to build all this infrastructure. You got to get all the inserts and get the artwork right and the right wood from the wide body tree or whatever. You have to put it all together and it has to be perfect and it has to follow all the other things. So it's a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge that we enjoy, otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. It's kind of maybe a sadomasochistic type thing, but, so we have to kind of find new ways to make them. So, you know, part of what I've been doing is kind of, we have to do more one-off type things. So we have to make it so we can make one translate, you know, not 100 translates and sit them on the shelf for, you know, 3 years selling them off. Same thing with cabinet art, same thing with decals, same thing with plastic parts. I got some information on, you know, some of the tooling costs for Williams. You know, I may be off, but I'm not going to be off that much. The Rudy Red or Ted faces, I think one of them was $55,000 tooling cost just to make that tool. So imagine nowadays, which is probably not $55,000, probably $155,000, to make, you know, somebody wants a Rudy face, and we say, okay, well, amortize $55,000 by how many you're going to sell, you know, a couple hundred, you know, the price on that thing would be through the roof. So got to find different ways to do it. You know, you can try to find the tooling, but even if you find the tooling, people aren't going to want to make, you know, a couple hundred. So we have to find new ways to do things. So part of what we do is we do, you know, custom quick mold type things where I can make 50 or 100 parts and the cost is negligible in terms of tooling costs and things like that. So all of these plastic parts that you've been seeing showing up are coming from us because we're making them out of this new process. So, you know, the Rudy jaws or the, I don't know what else, you know, some of the flipper bats and some of the, you know, various different custom plastic parts. Most of those are coming from us that we've found a process to do, you know, a small quantity with a low tooling cost to make a new part. All I have to do is have a great original, either an NOS or something like that, and then we do it. You know, same thing with digital artwork. Is everything we're doing is digital, unless it has to be done with silkscreen, and that's what we do. And we do it with the right equipment, the right way, through a lot of process that we've done, and so we turn out decent parts. And they're, you know, replicable, and, you know, I can do them on demand. So that's kind of what we've invested in for kind of building the next stage where we, you know, pretty much just add to our catalog. We add more and more translates, more cabinet art, more this, more that. And then there's an upfront cost of just doing the artwork, getting it ready to go, proofing it, and then we run it. So that's kind of the model that we do in PPS. You know, clearly we make, you know, metal brackets and all that kind of stuff, but we also do a lot of the custom stuff. Okay, let's see. A little bit of a note about licensing. So we're a licensee of Williams, so we have the right to do, you know, Williams Bally copyright, trademark. We have a bunch of patents and we can do things, but that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is that, you know, if you're talking about a Monster Bash or Indiana Jones, we can't do anything without having the people that own Indiana Jones or Monster Bash or Dracula or Elvira or anybody agreeing that we can go do it. And these guys are not stupid. You know, they all talk to each other. They all know the kind of the formula is that you have to pay money to be able to do anything with any of these brands. For the most part, every now and then there's somebody who's not with the program and it's cheap or free, but it's not getting any easier to be cheap and free with licensing. And so there's a big payment, typically a prepayment, that has to happen to acquire the rights to do any of these parts that have some of these copyright or trademark type things on them. So, you know, it's not as simple as, oh, we have the Williams license, therefore we can do anything. We can't. We can do a lot of things, and then we have to go, you know, I've got a spreadsheet with 30 different licensees and contacts and harassing them and trying to get them to do this. But, you know, quite frankly, they're not always interested because it's so low volume and low money to them that, you know, it's not like I'm at a toy store building a million, you know, pinball toys that they can collect 50 cents each and make, you know, $1 million. So it's really a challenge sometimes to get them to even want to spend the legal time to go put a contract together to license the parts. But, you know, we've done a few things. We've got Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Elvira, Scared Stiff, and I've talked to Evel Knievel's son, and he's good. And, you know, anywhere I can go, I go try to find the licensees and try to get the best deal we can to get parts in the market. But, you know, that's typically the way it is. And then quite often there's some odd cases where there's additional people. I mean, somebody said, well, what about the shadow back or the side cabinet? Well, when you have a character, an actor, and a title, you not only have to go look at the company that owns the shadow, but you also have to go talk to Alec Baldwin's agent and see how much money he wants. So it's not as simple as just doing the stuff. So anyway, you know, I don't want to get into too much about licensing, but just so people understand what it takes to do this. I mean, this thing here required just a license through CBS, which I have for Twilight Zone, and they're good to go. So, you know, that's easy. It wasn't non-painful because it costs a bunch of money to get the license. But anyway, at least, you know, the best way to convert that is to do some product and get things going. I'm going to go through a bunch of different categories of parts, the way I think about what we're doing, and kind of this is what we've done in the last year. So this is all done stuff, and then we'll spend some time talking about what we're going to do. But, I mean, we came here last year, we were brand new, so we, you know, it was our birthday, and so this year we're 1 year old, and, you know, kind of what have we done? So that's kind of what the topic was. So the most recent thing I did was, I don't know if it was Brian Kelly that suggested doing coil wrappers, but I don't know why I listened to him because it was real a pain in the ass to do it. But I had to go figure out all the different colors of tape and all the different coils and all the wording and where the wording split and all that kind of stuff. And it was not trivial because Williams records were not that great about everything. So, and there's like 9 or 10 different formats and widths of coil wrappers, and oh geez, you know, it was just a fun thing to do. So anyways, but we have coil wrappers. So why coil wrappers? Well, we're probably going to make coils, and then we'll put our coil wrappers on coils, and we'll have, you know, Williams coils. But I kind of figure a lot of people just have working coils. They just have ugly working coils, and so we made the coil wrappers available as well. Coil wrappers are a part number. They all have part numbers, and so they're legitimate things for us to go do. So, you know, I guess it's kind of for the extremists who want a very pretty underside of their pinball, but that's what a lot of people want. So we've done game manuals. Previously, game manuals were not allowed to be done, so we worked with Williams and kind of put together a reproduction manual that is halfway decent in terms of thicker paper and the foldouts, and kind of looked as close as it could be to an original without going through all the expense of the exact binding method that they use. But, you know, we've got a whole bunch of titles and more coming all the time. So manuals are back in the market, and they've been out for a few months. Cabinet decals, we keep doing cabinet decals. We just finished Star Trek. We're working on Indy 500 right now. No good gophers, the older ones like Taxi and things like that. So all of those are in the process of being done. These use what we call the next-gen process, which is a bunch of hardware and software and process to go make the artwork look as close as you can to silkscreen. So the same dotting and the same texture and all that kind of stuff. And it's been a lot of process to go figure out how to do that. So it's not easily replicable, and it takes a lot of time to go do it. But I think you'll talk to anybody that restores the, you know, games and has used this stuff, and it's pretty decent in terms of how the artwork looks and how it feels. I mean, I have a Twilight Zone up here you can come look at, and a Star Trek as well, just to see what it looks like. But that's kind of one of the things that we do in-house, and just keep adding more and more titles. People have asked about separating back box versus the cabinet decals, so the answer is kind of yes when it makes sense. What I don't like to do is create an issue with a customer who doesn't understand things. So when they order a Bride of Pinbot that's got this heavy purple, I don't want to split the back box up because the purples are not likely going to match. You're just not likely going to match. And so I prefer not to do that. You know, for things like Cirque du Voltaire or, you know, Star Trek or things like that, it's probably okay. So we'll go and separate those things when it makes sense, but I don't want to do it where I'm going to go create an issue and have somebody call me and complain and say our color's wrong when, in fact, the colors out of the factory were different, you know, all over the place. I have four different versions of Medieval Madness because we looked at a half dozen different games, and they were all different colors. I mean, one was very purple, one was very blue. I mean, it's ridiculous how much of a range they have on it. So it's always funny when I get a call and says, your color's wrong. And it's like, no, the color's not wrong. It's just Williams didn't kind of make one color mass-produced of anything. You know, depending on what day they did things and how things worked, that's the way things came. Anyways, we're doing that. We've been doing a lot of these pop bumper caps and all the artwork on the caps and things like that. So for more of the older games, the pointy star kind of caps, and these are hot stamped and printed and a lot better than what has ever been available from other suppliers. And in fact, this process took probably a year to get correct. In order to get those pointy stars colored correctly, it was just a nightmare to go figure out. So now that we figured it out, now it happens, and we could just put out as many titles as we can go figure out the artwork for. So those are all available now, and keep coming. And playfields. So let's see. We have playfields are probably the hardest thing that I have seen try to be done. It's just the complexity of what it takes to do them, and the aspirations of those doing them, and the reality of what it takes to get them done is not, you know, not anywhere near as simple as it looks. We just got the Twilight Zone playfield out of Mirko, who does them in Germany. Space Shuttle from CPR was just done. There's going to be a couple more before the end of the year. And a bunch of the mini play fields and so on and so forth. I would say the play fields are probably the ones that have kind of kicked us in the ass the most, just being so difficult to do and getting them out the door, you know, well, and all the drama around clear-coated and not, or, you know, how clear-coated or satin finish or this and that. You know, it's a bit of a challenge, but we're trying to get more because, you know, obviously playfields are one of the hardest things to get in order to restore your game. But, you know, they come out as they come out, and I'm trying to get more people to do them, which creates opportunities and challenges because I can't control everything. But, you know, playfields are coming. It's just a little bit slower than I would have hoped. Translights, we use the next gen process for doing translights. So we've done, I don't know, a dozen or so different translights at least now, and just keep doing them. And there will be more. We're going to do a lot broader set of translights than we've ever done. It's just we're sticking primarily to the 90s type things until we get them done. I think we've got Whodunit done, and Star Trek Next Gen is just about done. And and then we'll just kind of work through the other ones. I've got the Indy 500 license. I think I can do that one, you know, and just kind of, again, whatever the demand is and what people need, we'll go and prioritize and go do. And, you know, and I've got a medieval Translite here if anybody wants to look at it, unless I give it away before you get a chance to look at it. But again, these are, you know, white-backed, translucent, you know, same as original, has a film on the front, and they look like a Translite. So that's what they are. Targets, we're doing all the different targets, all the stamp targets, things like that. We just finished the mold for the tombstone, so we've got now the original tombstone targets coming out, and those are the ones without the hood on the top for things like KISS or Playboy or some of the earlier games. So now I think we've got, you know, Stern targets and the other ones done as well. So we now, you know, have that in-house to go, you know, run the targets and make whatever we need to make. And those are out as well. Back glasses, obviously, most people know we work with Classic Playfields to do a lot of things. So they do a lot of plastics, a lot of back glasses, mirrored back glasses, and play fields. So that's kind of one of the relationships we have of trying to get other people to do things that they do well and keep them doing. If anything, I try to push them to do more than they humanly can possibly do. So, you know, they've got a queue of just at least a year or a year and a half's worth of back glasses, plastics, and play fields that they're trying to get through the door. And so that's all operating under our license. And so, you know, I'm also working with Ron Webb, who's doing some early 80s or early EM-type glasses. And then there's some other things that will be happening soon about getting a lot more types of glasses out in the market. So things that, you know, people didn't think we could get out. Yeah.
I'd like to get a ringer on here.
We can pretty much do anything either in glass or plexiglass. I'm not always convinced that plexiglass was tried, I think, with some of the Gottlieb ones that they were doing. I know Haunted House, I think, was done on plexi. The problem I have is plexi scratches so easily. And so, you know, obviously it ships well, but it scratches well too. My inclination is probably to do more on glass than on plexiglass, because I think we're getting to the point where we can ship things and try to scream at FedEx or UPS and try to get our money back if things break, just tell them it was their fault. But you know, I think more on glass. There's processes that we're working with to get glass substrates that'll work on this stuff, either direct screen or some kind of sandwiching type mechanism. All right, EPROMs weren't in the market a year ago. Williams shut all that stuff down. They didn't want it. It was kind of like Wild West, and people were doing things that they weren't supposed to be doing. So we got a way to kind of put a sticker on each EEPROM that is serial numbered, and we know exactly where these EEPROMs come from, and that's the only thing that's out in the market. And when it's not, it gets quickly stopped. But so any EEPROMs are good to go. We're still working on lead ghosting EEPROMs. You know, looking at the source code is not as easy. The Williams way of coding how LEDs should or could work in a game are not exactly straightforward, but that's probably one of the other ones that has taken far, far longer to get in a decent. There's three or four different problems with LEDs and ghosting that we can take out maybe two of them, but can't get the other one or two. And so, you know, somebody goes buys an LED ghosting EEPROM and it still ghosts in certain cases, they're not going to be all that excited about what they just bought. So we're trying to kind of sort all that stuff out. decals. So we do a ton of decals, whether it's insert decals or apron decals or playfield decals or whatever decals. We do all the decals ourselves in-house. And, we just, finished these slot machine decals or Elvira decals, all the gazillion Target decals. Those are all done, and just keep doing more. And, the challenge usually is just getting good artwork. You know, for the Elvira Target decals, I scoured all over the place just trying to get somebody to add the artwork, take their targets out, give us a good scan, and then we can go do it. You know, the challenge with that was some of the neon colors, but we kind of sorted that out pretty easily. Molded parts, I talked about earlier. We just finished the Cactus Canyon guns and handles. That took probably about 3 weeks from getting the parts to getting the result. So, this is not a six-month exercise anymore to get parts. So we make all these kind of parts, typically ourselves. Otherwise, some of these vacuform stuff come through other suppliers, but we're just doing more and more. I was hoping to have them this week, but all the Bally logo guides, those should be done within the next week or two, for KISS and all the earlier games in, the red and the white and the long and the short and the single and the double. And then we just keep trying to find more things to go do. And, we've probably done at least 150 parts probably in the last 2 years of these types of things. You know, the gophers were really hard because they have to be decorated, a bunch of other things that we've done. We just did these red posts, the kicker posts for the early Bally's, Medusa type things, and, whatever we can do, we can do. You know, it's just trying to get them in the queue and get them done. So, if people have ideas of things that we absolutely need to do, then help get us a good, preferably NOS part, and we'll go see what we can do. Metal parts, we make a ton of metal parts, brackets and, anything else that needs to be made. It's not the sexy part, but, the stuff that breaks a lot or the stuff that is, scoops and things like that, we have made to the original specs, and that kind of is one of the core parts of what we do. Plastic sets, again, CPR has been doing a lot of plastic sets. We've done a bunch of the common, A title Williams plastic sets. In fact, I'm picking up Whodunit this week. So Whodunit's all done. Indy 500 is next. So Indy 500 plastic sets are next. The problem with Indy 500 is they lost the cut file, so they had the artwork, they just didn't have where to cut it. So we had to go get an original set and send them off and get the cut file made. But, we just keep trying to work through all the the DMD-type plastics, and then CPR typically does the 80s-type plastic sets, and then we're trying to get a few people to do more of the 70s-type, silk-screened, low run type EM type plastic sets. So just trying to get the coverage of the whole spectrum there. And that's it. So, that's kind of the categories of what we do, kind of what we're trying to do. I would say more of what we're trying to do in 11 will be obviously a lot more titles of artwork. Just trying to get the full spectrum of, if I'm restoring a game, what do I need, and I don't need to do ramps because James does ramps. There's a lot of things I don't need to do, but there's a lot of things on the artwork side, cabinet artwork, play fields, plastic sets, all that kind of stuff that we're either going to do ourselves or we're going to get done, and then it's just trying to figure out, how to choreograph all that to get it done in a decent amount of time. So I expect to have, a lot more to talk about next year. And like always, we want to hear what you think about what we need to do and how we need to do things better. But So with that, I'm going to end this and then just open up to questions. And then I think Sam, the man, is in the room. So I'm going to do the traditional giveaway of some stuff. Go ahead.
So you have all these parts and you have the right to make the herbal machine. Is there any plan to do something like that?
So we've done the deal with Jersey Jack. So a year ago, that same question was asked, are you going to make games? The answer is, I don't think I'm going to make a game. I think I'm going to help make people make games. So, you know, I want to be in the parts business. The game business is a lot difficult to do because it's not just building the game. It's the economics and the distribution and all that kind of stuff, which is a whole additional job to go do. So with Jersey Jack, we've done exactly what we wanted to do, which is to help make more pinball more accessible to people and put the right, you know, set of parts in there. You know, I do the same thing for Stern. I don't care. You know, it's like, you know, if Stern needs my patents, just give me a call and we'll figure something out. If Stern wants some Williams parts, I don't care. You know, why should I care? You know, I don't, you know. And so whenever we see a game platform trying to be done, then we'll just try to see if we can help get parts into that game platform. Now, what's a part? I mean, a part can be a pretty big assembly, like, you know, short of a game. Yeah, we might be able to do something like a very big part, you know, like maybe a kit or a play field or something like that. But that's a big undertaking to do a whole play field assembly replacement thing, you know, like a Congo type thing. I mean, the good part is we do the artwork, we can get the plastics, play fields, all the mechanical parts. So it's not within reason to be able to go make a play field assembly to go stick in a game, but you know, it's a big job to go assemble all that, test it, get it working, make sure there's no problems. It's, you know, it's short of a game, but it can be done. Yeah, of course, everything has to be perfect. I live in a perfect world. With all of you, we're in a perfect world. So, anything else? Other questions?
Okay. This
was done in Germany. This. Yeah. Quality is an issue for me. No, I mean, okay. So there. You know, the dead elephant is about quality of especially play fields. Okay. Any of the suppliers will tell you that I beat them. You know, when there's before and after quality issues happen. Okay, I've had calls with playfield vendors about how much clear coat is the right level of clear coat on a playfield and what customers should be getting. You know, I'm in the replacement pinball business. I'm not in the 1 foot thick clear coat playfield business. I'm in the replacement. I want it to look as close to original because that's what people's expectations are. And if you want to have an option to go do some fancy, shiny, you know, bullet-fast coating, that's fine. But for the most part, you know, we're in the business of trying to make things look as good as they were, you know, and better if they made a crappy product in the old days. But so the quality thing is I go work with people that have credibility and they know from the get-go that, you know, if it's not going to be quality, then I don't need them to be in the camp. The issue that frustrates me is when they don't pay attention to quality and then they think that they can pull one over on a customer. And it's like I go ballistic when that happens. I just don't like it. I don't work that way. Anybody that runs a business knows that you don't stay in business very long when you piss your customers off. It's not a good formula. And, you know, I hate this pinball mentality sometimes that says because we have rights that very few other people have that we can go treat our customers like shit. I don't get that. I don't understand that. I don't subscribe to it. So it translates to anybody I deal with. So it just, you know, I know from Bay Area how much time it takes me when I get a product that has some defect, you know, for whatever reason, and the amount of time and energy that I don't have to spend with the angry customer that got a, I don't know, a flipper bat that the shaft came off on, that my supplier kind of knew that that was going to happen, but he just hoped it wouldn't or the noise would die down. You know, I don't like that because I don't have time to do that. I don't have the desire to have unhappy customers, and I just don't, you know. So everybody that works with me knows that that does not make me happy, and then when I'm not happy, they're not happy. So it works that way. Go ahead.
Yeah, do you have the licensing agreement with the Amazon Clothes and other facilities?
No, not yet. I mean, not at this time. I went for Twilight Zone Star Trek first, and we, you know, the problem with licensing is if you get too many licenses too fast, you can't fulfill. And so if you go kind of this broad spectrum and go pay all this money for everybody, you can't make enough money to pay the royalties that you have to pay back to the people because you have to build these products reasonably quickly to get enough going in the market to pay back. So we'll keep expanding licenses as the products for the existing ones kind of burn in, okay? So, you know, I'm just finishing up the Twilight Zone Translite, or the Star Trek Translite, so now we've got the Star Trek Translite and apron decals and cabinet and some of the ships and, you know, not much else to do for Star Trek. So now that that starts paying itself off, you know, the Star Trek and, you know, the Star Trek and the Twilight Zone probably took about a year to kind of get going, you know. And so next year, I'll start looking at seeing what else we should be doing. We did Elvira, which was Scared Stiff, and Party Monsters just a few months ago. And so that's just kind of ramping up to, you know, we're going to be doing Scared Stiff Playfields and, you know, Elvira Playfields and stuff like that. But, you know, all these things take 3-6 months to get in the queue and get done. So the answer is yes, but it's kind of got to be orderly. Otherwise, we just burn time and don't get product out, and then it just kills you because you pay, I don't know, $5,000-$10,000 a year in royalties, which means you got to do $50,000-$100,000 worth of parts for one title, which ain't going to happen. So unless you really kind of get going, and it's really tough to do. So the answer is yes, but, you know, pacing things. So 2012, if the economy treats us nicely, then we'll try to do more like that. Yeah. The next generation play field can be in the cards. The challenge with that is that it is probably one of the most difficult artwork playfields ever invented because of all the nebula and all that kind of stuff. So the danger is that, you know, when you do silk screening of that kind of artwork, it may be really tough to get the exact look of that nebula. So I want to do it, and I challenge my playfield guys to go do it, but they're having a tough time figuring out if they can really do it. So it's something I want to get done. I just don't know if anybody wants to step up to take the risk. You know, again, you know, you start on this stuff, you know, you've got a whole bunch of money that you got to tie up to, you know, the playfield suppliers to go try it, and then, you know, they may spend a lot of time, you know, trying and failing on that one. So the answer is I want to do it, and any playfield vendor that steps up and says, yes, we're going to go do it, you know, we'll do it. But we may not get the perfect result. That's kind of a dangerous one to do. Yeah?
That's sort of a two-part question.
Okay.
While you're doing the licensing playfield, what inspired that? The great thing about Williams is there's a lot of products that you're using.
Right.
Are you going to sort of fill in the gaps between working on this license and waiting for that to take back to go to next one?
Oh, yeah. Sure. We do it. I mean, we do it all the time. It's just a lot of the A games, you know, the top titles were licensed themes, you know, Indiana Jones or Twilight Zone or Star Trek or those type things. You know, I've got a supplier who, you know, I've even announced that I'm trying to hunt him down, who's, you know, has the getaway play field done and has Bride of Pinbot in the works. So, you know, CPR is doing Tales of Arabian Nights. So it's not that we're not doing those things. It's just that those tend to be the ones that are the ones that take a lot of work and probably the most desired. But, you know, things like Circus Voltaire and others are, you know, we can do all those. We can theater magic, all that kind of stuff.
Everything for Bride of Pinbot now, of course, you know,
playfields
are allowed. It's not that nobody wants to explore. So I wondered if, especially Bride of Pinbot, for me, is any of those getting the, I don't know, urge mentioned, but are any of those in the works?
Yeah, no. Bride of Pinbot is, I think the artwork is all done for the play field and even the cut files and, you know, the supplier that is doing them is, I'm not sure if it's MIA or, I don't know what but it's the lost supplier problem. So I have to go find them and figure out how to kind of work through any of the issues that they're having or figure out to cut them and put it in somebody else's hands. This is what happens a lot is, you know, and it's not a criticism of any suppliers, but you start with a project, and I come from a world where I try to say this will be done, you know, and every now and then I fail, but I try to get it, you know, I try to at least tell people when it's going to happen and why. But sometimes other people don't work that way. And then they say it's going to be done in 6 months, and then 12 months, you know, they tell you when it's going to be done. And so, you know, I don't subscribe to that, but sometimes I don't have any control because I can't force people to get things done when I want them done. So the answer is Bride of Pinbot is in yet another supplier's hands who is doing the getaway first. And in fact, I sent him a message on the getaway saying, where's the getaway? Because the artwork and the inserts and all that kind of stuff are done. And it's just a matter, it's just the simple problem of silk screening them and putting them together that has to be finished up. And then after that was going to be Bride of Pinbot. So the answer is, it's going to be done. And if this guy doesn't do them, then I'll shoot it over to CPR or wherever to get it done. Back.
Any hope for Creature Holograms?
Creature Holograms are... I talked to Gene about this when Gene was talking to me. About the Creature Holograms. The problem is the Creature license, which Gene has, and the Creature... figure, which I can get, we can get access to, and then the process to get it done is probably the challenge, which is getting somebody to do it right, because you know there was a overexposure problem in the last batch that was done, and everything turned red and all that kind of stuff, which is pretty classic hologram, you know, holographic image processing problem where you. Do things wrong and things turn red. But so the answer is there are ways to get them done, but it may require too many parts to come together to get it done quickly and easily. You know, now Gene will probably hear this and then go do it, so that's good. So, but we talked about getting it done. We had about two of the three parts ready together actually close to a year ago, and it just hasn't been able to come together. Probably the next question is going to be the whitewater topper decal. So we went and figured that out actually about a year ago and figured out that it cost $15,000 to do the decal. And so I'm okay as long as I get $15,000 worth of people paying to go make the decal. I don't care, you know. I mean, but if you amortize that across, you know, even a couple hundred, it's still going to be a couple hundred bucks a decal, you know, and I'm not sure, you know how it works. You know, if eBay it's $400, then the first 10 will be $300, and the next 20 have to be $200, and then eventually, you know, you don't have the amount of people that want to pay that much to get something done. So the Whitewater Topper decal, we figured out how to do it. It's not trivial at all. Stuart Wright actually worked with me to figure that out, but it's just very expensive. So, you know, the only thing I could do is like a pre-order thing where I get commitments from a bunch of people to at least, you know, not have it be a $15,000 stack of decals on my shelf. I can't do that. Otherwise, you won't get anything else. Any other? Yeah.
So how close are you to
I can do pre-orders. I can do a reverse, you know, auction type thing, which is, you know, the number has to be $15,000 and the price can come down the more people join in or something like that. You know, God forbid if only 10 people come in, they're going to pay $1,500 a piece or something, but I guess that could work. Maybe I'll go find some software to do that for a new model of generating the money required to do expensive parts or something. But yeah, I don't have a problem doing it. It's just, you know, it's time and energy to go manage, you know, all of that stuff. You know, when I have to go spend 10% of my time to go keep track of receipts and unhappy people that didn't get their PayPal invoice for something that I haven't delivered yet, and you know, when I have to start spending all my time on administrative things, I'm not making parts. So, you know, I wish there was a service I could just, you know, contract to go do that stuff. So any other questions? Yeah.
Did you ever try to contact any of the old Williams distributors or
Oh yeah, I have the whole Williams supply list, so I know who supplied every part Williams ever made, made in the last 20, 30 years. So we use that and we try to dig up old suppliers and see what they have or see what they know how to make, and you know, usually that's not very productive because many of these companies just don't exist, or they've merged, or they threw away all this stuff, or, you know, this and that. Or sometimes we're lucky and we find stuff that we didn't think existed, and they go, oh, yeah, I've got that big old tool sitting in the back. We didn't know what to do with it, and we still have it. So, no, we do that. That's the first thing I do. When I go after anything, I go look at who the original supplier was and see if I can find them and get the part made. Yeah. 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 We have the code, and we, you know, I have a software background. We can compile the code, but there is not a lot of interest in, you know, modifying the code is something that we have to tend to talk to Williams a bit about, because, you know, our charter is to go make reproduction parts, not mess around with game rules and changing Williams code. That's not what we're supposed to do, and it's not something, frankly, I want to go do. Last year, the question came up, is somebody going to go finish Cactus Canyon code? Well, the answer is, yeah, it would be nice. It's been tried. The original designers tend to want a bit of money to go do that kind of stuff, and the bit of money is more than the money you would make off of them finishing the code. And the code is so ancient that you know, you're limited as to how easy it is to go do it. It's not just having a C++ compiler that you just go and quickly, you know, have a whole object library and go figure all this stuff out. It's back to assembler land and putting all this spaghetti code, you know, and finishing it up. So, you know, plus there's kind of a code with original game programmers. They don't like other people to mess with their code. And as long as they're still alive, they don't like that, you know. And so you tend to get on the wrong side of, you know, the wrong people. And, you know, it's not, I respect that because, I, you know, it's their creation. If they didn't happen to finish it, it's, you know, it's 20 years or 15 years, you know, they're probably not going to finish it. So, you know, plus it's dangerous. You have liability issues. You know, if you mess with this code and that code happens to burn a coil and a coil happens to burn somebody's house down, in the society that we have today, guess who they're going to probably try to hunt down, you know, is whoever has the biggest set of money in their pocket. So, which won't be me. It'll probably be, you know, Williams or somebody like that. So we don't want to probably spend too much time on code just because it, you know, we'll try to fix the LED issues, which is a simple thing, which in fact is just patching code with stuff that Williams already had done, like for Twilight Zone and things like, or for Theater Magic or some other games. But no, probably not too much messing around with existing code. I, you know, I'd rather go with a PROC, you know, re-engineered, you know, some new system that emulated the old games in the games, and that way you're at least on a new platform. You can extend the game. You can go create your own custom Theater of Magic, and I'd much rather go that direction, you know, assuming even Williams would allow something like that to happen. So, all right. Anything else? I mean, if there's anything people need, you know, or you know, think they need, then let us know. I mean, it's, I mean, I get a good vibe of what people need from, you know, Bay Area, because we just sell a lot of retail. But, you know, we're always listening to what's out there, you know, that's needed and how much it's needed and what people would pay for it and stuff like that. So that's kind of what drives what we do, you know, and then we go from there. Okay, so anyway, let's get the infamous Sam Harvey, who is my sidekick, and we have our traditional PPS giveaway of extravagant product, except the play film. That's not giving away. Okay, so wait a minute. You don't even know what the rules are. So, okay, so the rules are... So the rules are, I'll come up with something I'm going to give away. Maybe I should do that first, because then people will not get something that they absolutely have no interest.
Well, you see better than I do, so you can pick out the people, too.
Well, I don't want to do that, because I'm biased, right? I can't be biased. This has to be. Here we go. Okay, for the first giveaway is for, and these are really good, these Space Invaders Pop Bumper Caps with the real... mirror, they're very beautiful. Pop bumper cap set. So Sam is going to ask a question, and Sam is going to, you can't see?
I can see.
Okay.
I can see you.
Okay. All right, so Sam is going to go pick somebody in the audience, and they're going to answer the question. The first one gets it, gets the prize.
I guess just put their hand up, and then you can tell if they have. Capcom, who's not in business anymore, originally was called two different names. What were the two names that Capcom was called before it was Capcom? We stumped the professionals right out of the gate. That's good. Anybody have a guess? Do one of them. We'll settle for one then, I guess. That is correct.
All right. What was the other one?
GameStar.
And Romstar. All right. The next one is for a set of Elvira target decals. Full set. Neon ink, all the beautiful, laminated, won't ever wear out. Can sell on eBay for $20-$30.
Okay, in the flipper era, the most produced game was Addams Family. With 23,000 units. What game did that record be broke? What one had the record before that, and how many units?
Paintball.
Anybody know the amount of units? It's 20,230. So
I think that's within margin.
That's it.
Okay.
You can determine that.
You're the winner. Okay, the next prize is, how about we do Medieval Madness Translate? Ooh, $100 on eBay.
I guess you could come up with a pretty toughie.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It might be okay. An easy one, might throw everybody off.
Okay, this one may have been done last year, I can't remember. What is the difference of the card trays between the American Attaballs and the Italian Attaballs?
I know.
The Italian one didn't have the word flipper.
That is correct. Somehow the vernacular of the word flipper was not allowed in Italy, so that instead of it saying flipper buttons on side of cabinet, it said buttons on side of cabinet.
Okay.
Try to be informed of it.
Only from Sam. Okay, so this one will make a... You can pick your Pop Bumper Cap, either Captain Fantastic, Playboy, or Star Trek.
According to the information on the flyer, on the Bally games of the 60s that had the feature of the flippers being able to close where the ball couldn't be lost, what was that feature called?
The guy in the blue hat right there.
Zipper flippers.
What did you say? Zipper flippers? That is incorrect.
Oh, gee, the number of hands just changed. Right here. Go ahead.
That is correct. According to the flyer, I always thought it was zipper flippers too, but it was called flipper zippers.
That was harsh. Okay, which one? You got Captain Fantastic, Playboy, or Star Trek? Okay, guess what the next prize is. Pretty soon you won't have a choice. Go ahead.
Okay, Gottlieb came out with a feature in the mid-50s, 1954. All the games that had this feature, there were 8 of them, called the double feature. Someone please explain in vernacular exactly what the double feature was and how it affected the game. Mr. Shelburne.
If you pay double money,
Or push the replay button.
Right.
Incorrect.
David Marston here. Okay.
So if you put in a second coin, it's a second credit.
Or push the credit off, right.
It's a combination of paying twice as much for the game, then every time you're rewarded a replay, it activated a special coil that pulls the replay register ahead by 2 steps.
That is correct. There, in the replay unit, normally there were 2 coils in the replay unit, a step up and a step down. But when you activated the double feature, there were 3 coils in the add replay unit. And one coil stepped up the unit by 2 teeth of the replay unit, and one stepped it up 1, and the other one reset it. That I don't know, but I think it was an answer to
Wayne's now.
The Williams version of that was you would add extra coins, and the replay unit had a triple-digit replay unit so that you had a match number after the 3rd, 4th, and 5th ball, and if you matched on all 3 of those, you won 200 replays on some games in the 50s. Wayne would be able to answer that question that you just said.
Oh, it was just a gadget. It didn't make any money, really. It was just a sales gimmick is what it amounted to.
Okay.
I think, I'm not sure if we did that one last year or not. Let me think.
That's okay.
Oh, and is anyone, since Humpty Dumpty was the legendary game it was, with the first game having flippers that showed that you it was a game of skill instead of a game of luck. Does anyone know the original working title of Humpty Dumpty, what it was called?
Yes.
Flipper. That is correct.
All right. Okay. Okay, this one will be your choice of decals. You can choose any of these four, either Whodunit, Theater of Magic, Medieval Madness, or Doctor Who.
I think we did this one last year, though, but what was the first dot matrix game?
Right there.
Correct.
Okay. Come up and claim your fancy decal. You running out?
No, I'm not running out.
Okay.
I'm just saying, I'm trying to do the difficulty of the question in correspondence to the prize.
Okay. Go ahead.
What was the first game, according to the flyer, and it's if you look at Mike Pasak's flyer book, that had the idea in their mind of having a big flipper as opposed to the small flippers? This is real obscure, but this is informative also. It was on the flyer. Nobody's going to know that unless you're a flyer collector. But this is in it. It was in 1951, happy-go-lucky. And on the flyer, it had big flippers.
Uh-huh.
Be informative, too. The first ballet game to move the knocker from the bottom of the cabinet and the inside of the cabinet to the head. There was the last one that had the Jay Stafford helped me come up with this question. And where the knocker was in the bottom of the cabinet, and then they moved it to the head. Well, according to Jay, he looked it up on the internet, and Wizard was the last game to have the knocker in the bottom of the cabinet, and High Deal was the first game to have it in the head.
Okay, last question.
No one's going to know this. But the...
come up with one that people will know.
Okay.
That's the game that we're playing.
That's for sure. What was the original title, working title of Slick Chick, one of Wayne's most popular games, and how did he get the name Slick Chick from to change the working title to the name Slick Chick?
Go ahead.
Party Girl.
Yeah.
And he thought...
Yeah, it was. He was coming home from the factory or going to the factory one morning, and he went by a place called the Slick Chick Cafe, and then the bells went off, and he remembered that's going to be the name of the game now.
Okay, that to me is a winner. So pick your decal. That one? Okay. Okay, everybody, thanks for coming. If you want to see anything up here, you can see it. Otherwise, go to lunch, okay? Take care.